Life is full of mysterious circumstances. And back in the Stone Age, one of these mysteries came into manifestation for which we have never found an adequate interpretation. The people of the early Stone Age began to develop a certain ability, rather restricted, but indicative of things to come, to carve, cut, or shape various materials into likenesses or similitudes of objects. And during this period, practically all of these artifacts were of a purely physical or natural order. There were scratchings representing bison or ancient animals. There were carvings to represent fish. But everything that was done was apparently derived from the authority of nature. These people made pictures as best they could of the things that they could see. And apparently, the entire project was either of vanity or of historical recording. It's quite possible that the tribe attempted to perpetuate outstanding achievements of its members, or an individual sought to gain recognition for some deed of special distinction by carving himself a medal instead of waiting for someone else to hand it to him. In any event, this early period was marked by man beginning to make pictures. He wrote them on the walls of cliffs. He carved them in great masses of rock. They were all primitive, all very simple, all very obvious, and sometimes a little humorous. Then somewhere along the line in this mystery of the Stone Age, things changed. And then the second half of this Stone Age period, as we broadly consider it, the carvings progressed and advanced, at least they continued. But all of a sudden, practically every figure, every image, every likeness became religious. Now, what suddenly changed our remote ancestors' point of view, we have absolutely no way of knowing today. But for some reason, in a comparatively short time, his secular art was transformed into a sacred art. The possibilities are, of course, that the talismanic factor began to suggest itself. The man who created a likeness of something and wore this likeness perhaps experienced what he regarded as a protective circumstance. Some streak of good fortune struck his primitive way of doing things. He may have been saved from some terrible emergency and accredited this salvation to this figure or this image which he had cut. In any event, in the later part of the Stone Age, man became a designer of sacred images. Nearly everything developed meaning, and this flowering of change was so rapid that it was to influence practically all art from that time on. From the late Stone Age, therefore, to the present time, sacred art has had a continuing existence. In some periods, it was more prominent than in others, but it has never ceased. And man has continued to create likenesses of value, likenesses of principles, or of truths, or of ideas, which he held to be very important. Now, there's no doubt in the world that our most ancient artists were limited by their implements. They had to work with comparatively soft substances. They could not drill into any hard material. They could not successfully chip away into any reasonable likeness, difficult or heavily grained substances. Yet we do find at a comparatively early time the beginning of the arrowhead and the chipping of stone. Among our North American Indians, the art of the making of arrowheads from various materials, some of them quite hard and difficult to work. This art developed with amazing skill. And today, our ethnologists in this country are very anxious to preserve the old formulas, if they can, by means of which these arrowheads were so perfectly shaped with so little equipment. Down south of the border in the Aztec Maya complex, obsidian or volcanic glass began to be worked. In working this material, the danger of destroying the implement in the process of making it was very distinct and real. Yet we had found a tremendous number of finely cut obsidian objects, one of the most homely, useful, and mysterious of all being the obsidian razor blade. It may not be generally realized that the Central American Indian found that he could give himself a first-rate shave with this prototype of our familiar Gillette number. But in the old days, the obsidian glass could be chipped until its edge was as sharp as steel. And these razor blades, cut from volcanic glass, are some of them 8 to 10 inches in length, an inch wide, and probably a 1/16 to a 1/32 of an inch thick, with a very powerful cutting edge, sometimes, in honor of our modern concept, double-edged. These processes of working must have been exceedingly difficult with the equipment available. In fact, some of these problems of old times have led people to assume that our ancestor must have had some metaphysical means of chipping stone. But the Indians of our Southwest have pretty well demonstrated that traditional skill handed down from generation to generation can accomplish most of the wonders that we are able to recover from the past. So while the ancient man was creating his adornments and his various images and fetishes and so forth, he was also accumulating something else. He was accumulating an interesting collection of bright-colored pebbles. These bright-colored pebbles he couldn't do anything with at that time. They were too difficult for him to work. He did not understand them, but they were pretty. So he proceeded to keep them. And we find that occasionally he would find a natural one that had an interesting or remarkable shape, or came so near to fulfilling some mental image of his own that he did try desperately to work the stone a little, just to emphasize the point which he intended to make. These bright stones and pebbles became more and more fascinating as abilities, methods improved. Actually, researching into the field suggests an interesting psychological aspect to this. For we know that bright objects, such as our Stone Age ancestors rather enjoyed collecting, have also intrigued a number of birds, animals, and even reptiles. It is not uncommon to find that birds, particularly a certain type of crow, will gather up all kinds of bright objects that have no value whatever in nest building and arrange them in a pleasant design in front of the nest. They will frequently set them in openings or branchings of trees near the nest. In other words, they're going to get as nice and handsome a situation as possible Perhaps these crows were among the earliest of all the status seekers. They were trying to excel their neighbors in the glory of their possessions. Monkeys have much the same tendency. Any bright or unusual object will attract their attention, and they are well known in many parts of Asia for their thievery. They will steal anything that is bright or interesting, one of their favorites being a pair of eyeglasses, which they will carefully remove from the owner so deftly that he hardly misses them until he strives to read something or something of that nature. Animals will do this, and apparently the fascination lies in a bright, shining object. Now, these bright, shining objects seem to have another kind of fascination. Birds and some animals will remain for a long period of time in a perfectly silent condition, just looking at a bright object. This object seems to have a certain fascination or hypnotic effect upon the creature. And apparently, if we are to believe the old books and writings, these bright objects had a similar effect upon man. And in the course of time, this collection of interesting, crude, bright, pretty objects became involved in his artistry and in his religion. And many very early images have been encrusted or inset with crude, uncut stones. Stones that were simply put there because they were pretty. It was only a little step, of course, from this situation to man trying to improve these stones in one way or another, releasing from them more of their brilliance and their interest. Every step of the process is not known or recorded. But after a certain period of time, we find ancient man learning to cut stones. Not only learning to make interesting designs and figures, but gradually devising ways to release the natural luster or shine of the stone itself. The old methods were very slow, and it took sometimes years to polish a single gem. But the interest and the glamour of the stone apparently more than justified the labor. It is almost certain that more than decoration was intended, however. The stone must have attained already to a certain magical or talismanic importance. There had to be something of believing in the development of this art, as in practically all other arts known to man. By the time the first pages of history, as we know history, were recorded, the art of the stonecutter was distributed throughout the entire world. This is one of the most universal of all arts and crafts. And more and more, the cut gem had become associated with the highest value, with wealth, with honor, distinction. Even in old times, there was a sort of caste system set up. Certain jewels or gems could only be worn by persons of certain estates. The highest and the finest and the rarest, of course, always being reserved either for the head of the state or for the highest of the religious leaders of the area. Images of deities were more and more ornamented. Jewelry began to combine the working of metals with the insetting of stones. And in the very early time of our history, these beautiful objects were made, which are still excavated or found in the tombs of the old Egyptian kings. So we know that the belief in the value and importance of precious stones, and even semi-precious ones, this belief has descended to us, gathering along the way a variety of lore, many dramatic and amazing legends, good and bad, have associated themselves with this subject. Naturally, the moment anything becomes valuable, it becomes also a center for a certain amount of crime or of evil doing. And man early discovered that the value of the rare stone caused it often to be associated with tragedy. There's an old legend bearing on this that is rather intriguing, I think. In the very dawn of things, when God created human beings, he wanted to give them everything that would be pleasant and interesting. So he made in the meadows and in the mountains and in the valleys wonderful plants and flowers with many colored blossoms that were extremely charming and had wonderful fragrance and covered the world with beauty. And primitive peoples began to admire and love these flowers, and they made them into offerings for their deities and into decorations for themselves. And they lived very happily with these beautiful flowers, which were so common that no one really put any particular value upon them. They were available to all and a source of common joy. About this time, the devil came along and felt it was up to him to do something about this pleasant state of affairs. So he took all of the flowers, and he made stones like them. And he hid these stones in the earth. And he told people that the stones were not too common, but with great industry they could be found, and that they could be made into very permanent and valuable ornamentations. And everyone thanked the devil for the information. And they all went to work digging for these flowers of gem that were hidden in the earth. And they found them, and they made all these things. But because they were permanent and because they were scarce, people envied each other. And very soon these precious stones led to sorrow and crime and misery and death. So that the devil introduced this valuable object to take the place of a common beauty that we could all own. And in so doing, set up the way of evil over possessions and over beautiful objects. This, of course, is a legend that arose from the common experience of man. It became possible to consider going to war with your neighbor for his jewels, for his valuable things. And as material objects increased in value, covetousness increased in the souls of men, leading to all kinds of misfortunes. It is interesting and perhaps worthy of attention that for a very long time there have been set and definite opinions about precious and semi-precious stones. Opinions that are entirely contrary to our modern thinking. Yet who shall say that there might not be more to them than we are inclined to suspect. We are inclined to assume that superstitions simply represent old wives' tales, that they come down to us with no real meaning, simply the accumulated notions of generations. But as we look more closely into the beliefs of peoples, we become more fascinated by the basic integrities that underlie often distorted or exaggerated accounts. There seems to be some possibility that there is meaning or value or purpose behind some of these old stories. It is quite possible that the precious stone is more important to us, psychologically at least, than we have ever realized or considered. So let's take a few of the types of problems that came up in connection with this area and see what we can make out of it. First of all, practically all ancient carvings of precious stones or the settings for which they were prepared have some kind of symbolic meaning. These stones became associated with occasions, with purposes, with special meanings. And in their intricate settings in the 18th and 19th centuries, for example, these stones became words. And there was a method of cryptography by means of which an inscription could actually be concealed in a piece of jewelry by the arrangement and colors of the stones used. That there were many ingenious devices of this kind, we know. But out of the very beginning of this thinking came the conviction that stones had some kind of innate power of themselves. That the stone was perhaps not a living thing, as we commonly think of life, but that it had an aliveness in it. That the stone was a vital thing, and that the emanations which came from it were real, and had some kind of distinct and definite influence. This kind of thinking has been recorded in hundreds of early texts on stones and minerals and on talismanic objects. We also know that from the early period it was assumed that if a stone was engraved or a further likeness of something was cut into the surface of the stone or perhaps raised in relief from its surface, that this additional specialized cutting gave further meaning and further importance to the stone itself. Therefore, it was common to place upon the surface or into the surface of the stone inscriptions or likenesses regarded as having religious or magical meaning. When this occurred, this magical meaning was released, became active in the life of the individual, and the piece of jewelry became a talisman or an amulet or a fetish of some kind, a thing of power. Our modern psychologists will simply say that it was believing that did it, that the stone itself had no particular meaning, but that belief in the stone certainly could produce very marked variations in conduct. In fact, psychology today accepts that symbolic objects can profoundly influence the human mind, first because of the presence of mystery in relationship to the object, and second because the design or the decoration related to some traditional belief long held to be important, therefore sharing its importance with each generation. Someone tried to make some form of survey of this subject to find out to what degree modern man had overcome this old superstition. To what degree does modern man in the Western world, we'll say, still hold to various superstitions about the importance of talismanic objects, gems, and the like? Of course, no very clear survey could be made, but the indication was definite that the belief in these different talismanic values is probably today as great as it ever was in the history of the world. That so-called education, science, modern way of life, these have had very little actual influence. One answer, of course, is that man has become increasingly involved in hazards. Life has become continuously more complicated, and in the complication of things, law and order seem to disappear. We live still in a world of miracles, of mysteries, of hopes and fears, of joys and sorrows, of optimisms and of pessimisms. And wherever persons are engaged in these kinds of careers in which uncertainties are ever present, these persons still seem to need, or believe that they need, all the good luck they can get. And this good luck is often involved in talismanic objects of one kind or another. This type of thinking has always been very prevalent among theatrical people, whose career is especially hazardous, economically speaking. It is also a common fact that most persons engaged in dangerous occupations have some recourse to magic or mystery in connection with the things that they do. It is also known, for instance, that a very large percentage of the men who went to war carried sacred medals, medallions, or blessed objects in the hopes of protecting themselves by this means. Those who cared for them and waited at home also kept a variety of such objects. Most persons in such occupations as aviation and so on have a tendency to want good luck charms and things that give some semblance of protection. And the stories of those who have defied this or have neglected to keep their charms handy, these stories are also rather clearly indicated that the loss of this fortunate object had a very detrimental effect upon the psychology of the person. So from the most primitive to the most civilized, man still has a belief in magic locked somewhere in his nature. For the most part, this belief is subjective, but it comes out occasionally in periods of stress or tension. The development of gems for various purposes of a magical or mysterious nature probably began somewhere between 10 and 20,000 years ago. It reached a comparatively high degree of integration and organization by the beginning of the historic periods, which commence about 5,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. From that time on, the collections and accumulations of sacred gems and stones, or magical objects of this nature, these are reported in practically all important books dealing with their times. We might expect, and it is true, that the city of Alexandria in North Africa became closely associated with this peculiar cult also. The cult of the talisman flourished there at an old, old time, perhaps as a result of it being a crossroad between the East and Europe. In Alexandria, there were entire organizations that did nothing but cut talismanic stones. And, of course, to a measure, the Egyptians of the earlier period, through their scarabs and other symbolic and talismanic objects, had already gone far in the unfoldment of these magical beliefs. The use of stones for religious and symbolic purposes also appears early in the rise of Christianity. And I think we may say that by the end of the first century, the stone as relic had already occurred. And by the fifth century, it was almost universal throughout Christendom. And pilgrims traveling in various parts of the world nearly always carried either metals or substances of some nature, inscribed stones, often with the mark of the cross or of the fish or some other early Christian symbol, as a protection. Some of them probably perished for their protections, because many of these early travelers were killed for the jewels that they carried. But for the most part, they held that these stones were a source of help. Pythagoras is also known in Greece to have carved or caused to be carved mathematical and geometrical symbols upon stones and upon metals to be used for worship or for magic or for various ways of controlling elements and things of that nature. The stone, then, does present us with a very interesting series of problems. The various precious stones, of course, are for the most part chemical compositions. And the question still remains whether these stones do emanate any kind of a potent energy or have any distinct or definite effect upon human consciousness. Brightness glitter, we know, is highly attractive. We also know that a beautiful stone, beautifully finished and polished and cut, is an object of beauty, that it is therefore subject to admiration, that the individual finds a pleasure or joy in seeing it, and for hundreds of years people have had a great joy in possessing these objects. But whether this goes any further is a question that has never been satisfactorily answered. Color, of course, ties immediately into the very base of the problem. Here, psychology knows there is a valid ground, namely that color does affect consciousness, that color can have a definite therapeutic reaction, and also that it can cause, apparently, sickness or pain or distress. As these various stones were more or less fountains of colored light, that from them either there was a glitter, a glisten, or a gleam, and that this emanation conveyed color very quickly and sharply to the subconscious faculties of man, this there can be no reasonable doubt about. Actually, we have a knowledge now through the spectrum that colors represent materials, that colors arise from elements. And we are still of a question as to whether or not the element itself is radiated or projected through its own color radiation. Is it possible that the light pouring apparently from a precious stone, but actually a light arising in the sun and reflecting the light of the stone, is this actually carrying some form of specialized energy? Energy that differs according to the color and may also differ according to the chemical composition of the material. Do we take in through the eyes some subtle amount of chemistry derived from the color factor? We know that the same apparent color, or a very similar one which we can scarcely distinguish, can arise from different chemical combinations. Therefore, all red is not the same. Is this chemical emanation problem one in which different kinds of red, we will say, can variously be recorded within the consciousness of the person? Do these stones carry some kind of life energy with them? We go back to Paracelsus, who had many opinions on many subjects. And while we regard these views today rather dimly, we cannot say that we have ever actually disproved them. We have simply dropped them as being inconsistent with the general body of our thinking. Paracelsus was of the basic opinion that minerals and stones and metals were actually living things, and that therefore a beautifully cut stone was not merely a thing of beauty. It was a center of energy. It had a nature, force, or quality of itself. This, of course, has been one of the questions that has been difficult to answer. But if it may be assumed that there is any kind of a definite key energy related to these different compounds, then, of course, it is conceivable that this energy may be communicated through the eye of the beholder and may have some form of a subtle reaction upon the life or consciousness of the person. Paracelsus might be inclined to assume that it was the energy that created this consequence. The modern thinker would be more likely to assume that color symbolism was the true or important factor, that the human soul does respond to color, that color therapy is valid, and that color is as distinct and important in the treatment of disease as sound another way of reaching into the unconscious source of man's difficulties. Paracelsus also assumed that when these stones had been cut with certain mathematically designed figures, certain formulas, symbols, or the representations of creatures or deities, or the mysterious cabalistic symbols of the signatures of angels and of demons and of beings of the invisible world, that these stones then gained increasing intensity of purpose, and that into them could be captured various magical agents that could profoundly influence human life. Paracelsus therefore used precious stones in the healing of disease. And at one time it was not uncommon to grind them up and take them dissolved in wine as an internal medicine. The effect of such internal medication is perhaps somewhat a problem, but you may remember that the late Rudolf Steiner worked considerably on this problem in connection with his theory of remedies, going so far as to make use of meteoric metals in the preparation of medications for human use. The subject may never be completely solved to everyone's satisfaction, but the fact remains that among the ancients it was definitely assumed that the mineral and the precious stone were both living things, and being alive had some energy in them, an energy that could be communicated to persons. We have many reports, either traditional or semi-historical, of the effects of various people upon jewels. That when certain persons wear these stones, the stones lose their luster or become comparatively unimportant, whereas another person wearing them, the stone itself appears to change. Is this a meaning that might indicate that the individual has emanations, which in turn can affect the stone? We have to realize basically that stones, like everything else in the universe, are rates of vibration, and therefore that various vibratory patterns can affect each other, perhaps only slightly, but still to the degree of producing some modification that could be sensed or realized or known. All these different speculations lead finally to one rather consistent body of symbolic lore, and that relates primarily with the use of these stones by means of astronomical or astrological calculations, or by cabalism and magic. One of the earliest sources, for example, of the concept of birthstones, or the stones which are closest in affinity to individuals born in various months of the year, fortunate stones, or protective stones. The earliest pattern of this probably is derived from the breastplate of the high priest of Israel, where the 12 tribes of Israel were represented by 12 precious stones, or 12 precious and semi-precious stones. These, therefore, became talismanic, or symbolic of the members of the tribe. The 12 tribes were at an early date identified with the zodiac. Therefore, it was only a little time before the gems of the tribes became diffused through the constellations. And it looked very much to ancient man that a star shining in the sky was a kind of diamond set up there. And as the stars themselves often showed distinct coloring, all did not shine with the same clear white light, the possibility of an affinity between stars and stones grew in the primitive thinking of mankind. After the association with the breastplate of the high priest, the idea of talismanic stones and religious gems as birthstones passed through a very wide variety of adaptations, until today we can call upon the symbolism of a dozen countries and probably as many periods in history to come to some common conclusion as to how these stones were distributed. It might be pointed out, as always, that there is not complete agreement. The Arabs had one concept, the early Jewish writers had another, the early Christian writers had another still. In the Far East also, symbolic stones have become important in many magical and mystical ways. Their symbolism does not always conform entirely with that of Western peoples. So we have a distribution here of beliefs and ideas. But one point remains, the tendency to associate the stones with the months of the birth of the person, his ruling planets and stars, and particularly the planetary ruler of his nativity. These stones are then supposed to support or assist or protect or add to the importance of the good qualities bestowed by the stars. Therefore, also, they were protective against various evil forces. It is quite possible, in fact, considerable thinking has been done in this field, that there is a basic color key by means of which persons born under various signs can be, we will say, particularly approached or reached in terms of energy. That each of the 12 signs bestows upon those born under it a key color note. That this color is associated very definitely with the subconscious root of the psychological life of that person. That this color becomes an important key to his own life. He may or may not be aware of this color. He may accidentally have a selectivity about it. He may prefer certain colors. But it is assumed in the old ways that if the color key is found, then this color key can supply some information about stones and fabrics and various color patterns which are used by people in their daily living. Might even affect your selection of the color of your automobile. That many people differ in their color choice, and what looks like a beautiful shade to one person is an ugly color to another, indicates this basic individuality, that these color patterns do not necessarily always agree. Colors are also associated with certain important episodes in the life and death of the human being. And in the West, for example, black has always been associated with death. In Asia, the tendency is for white to take its place. So that here we have an almost complete opposition of belief, or a contrary. Now, why should we have this? Does it have something to do with the kind of belief that we hold about death? For instance, would the consideration of black as a color of death be more common with a people whose optimism about the after-death state is not too great? In other words, if death is a disaster, perhaps black, which is a negative color, would be suggested. Whereas if death is regarded as a fulfillment, a release into a larger life, then the element of mourning would largely disappear from it. And the idea of the white life, which would be a symbol of spirit in opposition to black, which is a symbol of matter, would cause these people to use a color consistent with their hope or their viewpoint or their conviction about the state of life after death. It is also true that in stylization, patterns have been derived as to public attitude and change of color, style, decoration, and ornamentation. There has been a certain amount of work done to indicate that as social conditions change, as economic problems vary, they are reflected in the colors people choose to wear.